So we started off by saying, isn't this a very similar incident? Here's Nehemiah mirroring, or actually here's Churchill mirroring what Nehemiah was doing. Never, 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 never give in. In chapter 1 and 2 of the book, we've seen a man passionate about God's cause. Pray and act. He plans, motivates, organizes, and gets on with the task of getting back to Jerusalem, rebuilding its broken walls. And in chapter 3, there's a great list of all the families that are involved. Each bit of the wall that they rebuilt, each beam that they put back in place. And it's a great display of unity and courage. The great building project of God's work back then was the reconstruction of the walls of Jerusalem. The task that we have as Christians is not a physical building project. It's a spiritual one. Yes, we're to build a church, but not one of bricks. One made up of saved sinners, rejoicing in what God has done, forgiving them, loving them, and giving them a peace that is theirs forever. That's what we are building. That's where our hope is. And we get to play a part in the structure going up, don't we? As we see people one by one, hearing from us and responding to the gospel of Christ, trusting him with their lives, and starting to live in his way, they join that great building project themselves. And what they end up with is a purpose for eternity, a meaning that no job or financial package or career or even children or relationship can compare with. The church swells with people ready to stand for the cause of Christ. And it's a precious cause to be involved in. It's right that that's exactly where we are as Christ Church, South Cairns. We're close on Nehemiah's heels, and I pray, armed and certainly by the end of the sermon, forewarned about what to expect. So what then can be expected of any great building project that we're going to get involved in of God's? Well, these chapters of Nehemiah are clear that it's going to be tough. The first thing they say is, expect to face ridicule. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 6. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. What did he do? He ridiculed the Jews. There are always going to be those who are threatened by Christianity. When a church appears to be making progress, when people are growing as Christians, when people are trusting Christ for the first time, it'll seem that their values and choices are somehow under attack, and they'll lash out. Isn't that what happens? He ridiculed the Jews. What are those feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore the wall? There's hardly a decent work party, let alone a good tool between them. No chance. Are they going to offer sacrifices? Are they going to finish in a day? Can they bring those stones back to life from the rubble? Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What are they building? If even a fox climbed on it, he'd break down their wall of stones." How they laughed. Happy, though, that only a few chapters later, there was an enormous procession, a ceremonial procession, with hundreds of people walking on top of these completed walls. How is the church doing these days? Somebody might ask us. How's your church plant? Say a prayer for us, heathen, won't you? You know, we'll get tired of science and common sense at some point. You might just persuade us. How do you react to that kind of mockery or ridicule? Listen to Nehemiah's prayer in verse 4. "Hear us, O our God, for we are despised. Turn their insults back on their own heads. Give them over as plunder in a land of captivity. Don't cover up their guilt or blot out their sins from your sight, for they've thrown insults in the face of the builders." That's a pretty fiery, passionate prayer, isn't it? He's clearly riled by their comments, but he still did the right thing. He didn't lash back out at those who were ridiculing him. He took his anger to God in prayer. They trust that God will bring justice, and that then liberates them to be courteous when they are being mocked. Not to retaliate or insist on having their say in return. They simply, verse 6, keep at the task, working with all their heart. So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. They're not ashamed, they don't falter, they simply stick to the task. Do you remember Jerry Springer, the opera, and the furore that was kicked up about that? Mocking Christianity in a way that no other religion would be mocked. The Vicar of Dibley mocks Christianity. The media portrays Christians as bigots on many fronts. And we shouldn't be surprised. Jesus, after all, was spat at and mocked and given a crown of thorns, he suffered in silence as they jeered at him. Builders in God's church should expect no less. Expect to face ridicule. Well, that's the first one. I wonder if you spotted a few of these others. Expect to face intimidation is the next one, verse 7 of the same chapter. The wall had been half built. Things had been going really well. The people in Judah then said, verse 10, the strength of the laborers is giving out. There's so much rubble we can't rebuild the wall. There is discouragement and a sickening sort of dipping of morale. Don't we ever feel like that? Does your morale drop in this great building project that we're involved in? We set out with high hopes and prayerful hearts for an opportunity to invite friends to hear something of this great good news, and they don't come. Or they do, but they don't want to listen. Or you get halfway through a course and wondering, actually, I'm not sure this is worth turning out to anymore. It's easy for heads to drop and discouragement to set in. And in Nehemiah, it was intimidation that was causing this. Verse 8, there's a coalition of the heavies, and they're angry, and they're uniting to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble. The rumors have got round, and by verse 11, the people are frightened. What do they say? Our enemies, before they know it or see us, we'll be right there among them, and we'll kill them and put an end to their work. That's what's going to happen. So the ridicule has turned to death threats. Thankfully, it's not something we've yet faced in this country. But as we'll hear, there are brothers and sisters around the world who do face it. The people involved in the work were ready to begin to give up. Even friends and allies, people they'd trusted before, were ganging up and urging them not to carry on. Nehemiah responded quickly with an admirable solution. Verse 9, we prayed and I posted a guard. Now that combination of the two things, dependence on God and practical human action, are what's to do. They're echoed in the words spoken by Oliver Cromwell in regards to fighting. He said this, trust in God and keep your powder dry. Charles Spurgeon, great preacher of the two centuries ago, who said, pray as if everything depended on you, and then preach as if, sorry, if everything depended on God, and then preach as if everything depended on you. So what they're all saying is, pray and act. In verse 13, Nehemiah stations people in the vulnerable spots on the wall ready for a fight. He posts guards day and night, works out a plan for reinforcing wherever it's needed. He rallies the people and stirringly tells them great words that would have echoed Moses and Joshua. Moses on the edge of the Red Sea, and Joshua on the edge of the Promised Land. Don't be afraid. Remember the Lord. And the people carrying weapons of war in one hand and digging tools in the other pressed on in the face of the opposition. What would it take to stop you living for Christ? Pressing on in Christ's cause. Maybe a realization that you've just not been invited by a bunch of friends who used to invite you to something because of something you said. Maybe there's a withering put down from an atheist skeptic. Maybe there's a threat of legal action if we cross parish boundaries for the sake of the gospel. Expect to face intimidation, but don't let it stop us. The difficulties won't be limited to those that come at us from outside. The problem chapter 5 describes is an internal one. Did you see that? Expect to face division. Sad, isn't it? Chapter 5, verse 1. The men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. What was going on? Well, the Jews were getting desperately fed up with fellow Jews, because at a time when they could all have been expected to be united in one cause, rebuilding Jerusalem's walls, many of the people who'd left fields in order to get involved in the building project weren't able to pay for their own food, and so they had to mortgage their fields. And when it got to the end of that, they had to put themselves into slavery of some sort. And who were they doing it to but the better off Jewish folk? Chapter 5. Although we were of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we're powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others. Now, it wasn't actually illegal, but it shouldn't have been happening between brothers in the family of God. The richer were taking advantage of the needs of the poorer, and it was causing division. Not surprising then that Nehemiah's first instinct is to anger, verse 6. When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. He could have destroyed the whole project right there. Said something in the heat of the moment. But what does he do instead? He doesn't let loose, verse 7. He holds back, thinks hard about the situation for a while, and then in a calm and very measured meeting, he challenges the nobles and officials. You're exacting usury from your fellow countrymen. A thing that was forbidden in Jewish law. The response is deafening silence because they keep quiet, they've got nothing to say. He's nailed the point. And that's a good sign. It shows that they're not going to hide behind a smokescreen of excuses. And they agree to mend their ways. Isn't it true that mistreatment from people outside the fellowship is understandable? When an unbeliever gets the wrong end of the stick and lays in, we can weather it. But when fellow believers, those who should understand better, those who we consider to be on our own side, start laying in, that's when it really hurts. King David knew the pain of betrayal by friends, as did the Lord Jesus Christ. Some of you may have heard of Jonathan Edwards. He was a famous and able preacher during the Great Awakening in America in the 1800s. He had his congregation take offense at him. They didn't like him challenging them on the way they and their families were behaving. They started a whispering campaign against him to oust him, accusing him of being power crazy. And after a painful number of months, the congregation did manage to evict him. And he preached a moving last sermon, full of love and compassion for those he was leaving. And he said how he would continue to pray for them and how he was sure that God would enable them to flourish. And then he went on to serve elsewhere. Division in amongst the people of God. Expect to face it. In chapter 6, Sanballat and Geshem hear that the wall has been completed, all bar the hanging of the gates, and so they switch tactics of last shot, see if they can stop the building project in its tracks. First, there's the delaying tactic of calling for meetings to talk about the project. Did you see that? Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Let's chat about what's going on. Nehemiah smells a rat and responds wisely. Verse 3 of chapter 6. Why should the work stop while we meet up? They're persistent and they try three more times. Come on, let's meet up. And it would have been very easy to have said, what harm can talking do? We might as well just go and talk. But he doesn't stop. He knows Sanballat's game and he sticks to his guns. And sure enough, Sanballat reveals his true colours because he sends Nehemiah another request to talk, but this time there's an open letter involved. And that open letter gets read, and in it is a series of deep misrepresentations about what is going on. We should expect to be misrepresented when we're involved in God's building project. The aim for Sanballat is to undermine his leadership, discredit him. Verse 6. It's reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true. This is what everyone's saying, Nehemiah. That you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you're building a wall. You need the wall because you're planning a war. Your plan is to break away from the Persian Empire in the end, isn't it? Moreover, according to these reports, you're about to become their king. So that's your game, Nehemiah. Personal power. And the fact that it's in an unsealed letter is striking, isn't it? He wants other people to have read it by the time it gets to Nehemiah, for these rumours to have spread. It's the equivalent of a letter written by blog for everybody to read. That's the intention. He wants Nehemiah to be given short shrift by the Persian authorities with no redress. And isn't it still true of the world and the media's portrayal of Christians? We're either portrayed as nice but dim, I mentioned the Vicar of Dibley, or as unreasonable, fundamentalist, placard-waving bigots. There's no reality in any of those. They're not interested in the good news of the gospel. They want to paint us in extremes. And that's misrepresentation, and it's as old as the hills. It was happening to Nehemiah. We shouldn't be surprised if it happens to us. Expect to face temptation. Chapter 6, verse 10 to 14. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehatabel, who was shut in at his home. The man was likely a prophet. He would have claimed to have had a word from God for Nehemiah and said, come and see me, I've got something to tell you. He said, let's meet in the house of God inside the temple. Let's close the temple doors because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you. It's got the sort of rhythm of a prophecy. But actually it's more intimidation. This time with an urgent appeal to get Nehemiah to run for safety to, of all places, the temple inside which he wasn't allowed to go. Only priests should go. He's saying, listen, forget the protocols. Your life's in danger. Run for safety now while you can. But God grants Nehemiah the sense to refuse. Verse 13, he'd been hired to intimidate me so that I'd commit a sin by doing this, and then they'd give me a bad name to discredit me. They're trying to trip him up. Temptation has been put in his path to think of himself first, to discredit God and disobey God's word. And the further we go on in the Christian life, the more we're going to face that kind of thing and cross our paths, aren't we? If we're open about who we believe in, about the cause we follow in the public arena, sure as eggs are eggs, there'll be pressure mounting on us to compromise, to give in, to drop our guard. It may come through money, or the lure of sexual temptation, or some attractive power play. Wherever it is we've got a weakness, be sure that's where we'll be attacked. Jesus was tempted, but without sin. We should expect temptation, but we shouldn't give in. And that's the lesson. Nehemiah and the Israelite wall builders faced this amazing onslaught of different pressures from every angle in this building project. And they bore up under the pressure and got on with the task. Against all expectations, the wall got built. Look at verse 15. The wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. It took them longer to build the porch on my house last year. This is a phenomenal piece of work. Yes, the walls weren't quite as impressive as Solomon's, but it was amazing. And what's the result? We didn't read it. Look at verse 16 of chapter 6. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence. Their pride, their arrogance, their self-confidence was pricked like a bubble. How on earth could they have done what they've done so quickly? You see, even the people who were opposing them had to admit there was supernatural help here. It couldn't have happened without God. And as a result, they lost their self-confidence. They realized this work had been done with the help of our God. And the encouragement there is, when God's on our side, then it really doesn't matter what stands against us. How tough the tasks look, how insurmountable the odds. Remember the Lord, he's the one who made the universe. He is the God of infinite power who moves the hearts of kings and their courtiers. He's the God who's promised that he'll build his church, and that through the labours of the hands of a people passionate about his agenda, he'll do it. So if God is at work in us and through us, then nothing should cause us to give in. What if you're not yet committed to Christ's cause? Well, then I urge you to think very carefully about it. Don't jump in. Take stock and recognise that standing with Christ is not an easy task. There will be lots of opposition. But don't stay on the sidelines mocking, saying it can never be done, or it'll never come to anything, or you'll just never grow. Because that's a recipe for failure, for your opposition being seen to be empty, for your self-confidence being pricked. That's the route to shame. You see, God's work does flourish. His church is being built. How else can we explain the survival, let alone the health, of God's church worldwide 2,000 years on from Christ, when there has been enormous amounts of opposition in all these different ways? It would not have happened but for God supernaturally making it happen. He is sustaining, upholding. Of course it's not going to be easy. It never has been. Not genuine Christianity. But the help of God is more than enough for us. We should expect to face ridicule and intimidation and division and misrepresentation and temptation and more. But the message from these chapters is what? Never, never, never never give in. Well, let's go back to these chapters and be encouraged by the opposition that was faced and the results that God brought about in the months that we have ahead of us and in our own Christian lives, living to serve Him.